This is Radio Boston. I'm Tiziana Deering. A great deal in the news today about further lifting of pandemic restrictions here in Massachusetts, and we will bring you the latest and give you a chance to ask the doctors later in the hour. But first, Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley joins us now live. The Congresswoman has redoubled her calls for police reform in the wake of last week's guilty verdict in the trial of Derek Chauvin for the murder of George Floyd. She's also been thinking and writing about the painful mix of solemn relief and stark acknowledgement that there's still so much more to be done. Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley represents the 7th Congressional District. Congresswoman, welcome back to Radio Boston.
Good to be with you, Tiziana.
So, Congresswoman, a lot of emotions this past week, a lot of pain. How are you?
You know, in the wake of the Chauvin verdict, I hope that the Floyd family, I want to start with them, I want to center them, that they have a little more peace. But what they certainly don't have is justice. The system could never deliver justice, because true justice would mean that George Floyd would still be alive today. And if I'm being fully transparent, I never expected the trial to deliver justice, but did push for and demand accountability. And that is what the jury delivered, accountability. And Derek Chauvin is now going to face consequences for his actions. But make no mistake that one verdict is not system change. Our legal system remains deeply unjust. And the fact that a person's murder had to garner global attention in order for us to realize accountability in just one verdict, after the countless lives that have been interrupted and that we've been robbed of, is unconscionable, unjust, unacceptable. So we can't bring George Floyd or the others back, but we can and we must legislate in order to deliver the critical resources our communities need, in order to break and to be freed from this endless loop of trauma that we're experiencing daily. So we're going to need to be precise and intentional. We're going to have to demonstrate political will and political courage. Again, this is going to require system change. We can feel ourselves in the midst of a culture change, but this is going to require system change. And that's going to require policy and budget change.
So let's talk about that. And I, you know, last week we had a number of conversations here on Radio Boston about this relationship between accountability as step one, but a larger need for justice. I recall last week former Governor Deval Patrick saying on Morning Edition, calling out specifically the fact that police reform is languishing in the U.S. Senate. I know that has been a focus for you. What are the next steps there? And is that a necessary piece of this bridge from this first moment of accountability to the kind of justice you're talking about?
Yeah, I mean, what I need my colleagues in Congress and at every level of government to understand is that the only thing that matters in this moment is meaningful policy change and budget change, period. So what does that mean to me? That means passing my bill with Senator Markey to end qualified immunity. This is an unjust doctrine that has denied accountability for those abused at the hands of law enforcement. It's been, you know, codified in statute after statute. What else does this policy and budget change mean? It means prohibiting federal funds from being used to maintain police in our schools. When every child does not have access to a school nurse, a social worker, or a guidance counselor, it means we need to end the school to confinement pathway, which disproportionately criminalizes and then pushes out Black and Brown students. It means we have to legislate to dismantle these systems. Systems that have created conditions for police brutality. And instead, we've got to secure resources for trauma-informed, community-based solutions, ones that the communities have demanded, that they deserve, and that they require. And also, I know I've spoken about this on your show previously, there's a broader framework that I'm working within as well, and that's my People's Justice Guarantee, which is really just a radical reimagining of our criminal legal system It offers a vision for true justice, healing, accountability. And that's about dismantling mass incarceration and really ushering in an era of mass decarceration. And that happens when we stop criminalizing things like substance use, mental health, homelessness, poverty. You know, Tiziana, we can't under-resource and divest from community. People then go to do survivalist behaviors, and then those behaviors are criminalized.
So I'd love to narrow that focus there further to talk about the bill that you reintroduced to end disproportionate punishment of girls of color in schools. Of course, 16-year-old Micaiah Bryant remains on everyone's mind after being shot by a police officer in Ohio last week. You're talking about these deep systems changes in funding, changes in focus. Talk about the way we are treating women and girls and what this bill sets out to do.
Sure. Well, the bill that I reintroduce is the End Push Out Act. And that legislation, the foundation of that, started in my time on the Boston City Council. And that was inspired by, you may remember a case where there were two sisters who were suspended for, I think that was that in Medford? For wearing their hair in protective styles, hairstyles, and an ethno-Afrocentric hairstyle. And so I then did evidence-based focus groups with 100 girls throughout our Boston school systems with my thought leader, Dr. Monique Morris from the National Black Women's Justice Institute. And what that confirmed for us is that despite policies that on their face appear to be race and gender neutral, that they were disproportionately resulting in higher rates of discipline, suspension, and expulsion for Black girls.
It was Malden, by the way, just so you
know. Oh, yes, Malden, yes. Black girls receiving punitive responses to typical adolescent behavior, so punishment that is disparate compared to the adolescent behavior displayed by their white peers. Black girls being criminalized simply for how they show up in the world, how their hair grows out of their hair, how their bodies are shaped. And so that work on the council became the foundation for my End Push Out Act, which is about making those investments in the restorative justice practices, in the socio-emotional wellness supports, in the things that are proven to support our children and our girls, and also the collection of the data. That was something under Betsy DeVos that was changed. We need the data so that we can make these corrections in real time, so that our schools are safe places for all of our children, but especially for Black girls.
And just for our listeners, a reminder, Betsy DeVos was the education secretary in the Trump administration. You just talked about your time on the city council. I want to come back to the district again here for a second, Congresswoman. It's been a tough month. 73-year-old Delois Brown was shot and killed on her front porch a few weeks ago. Basketball star Terrence Clark died in a car accident last week on the cusp of entering the NBA draft. I understand you attended a vigil at his childhood home. We talked with Tony Richards yesterday, one of his former coaches. And we also talked with Mark Scott of the City of Boston about trauma response right after Ms. Brown was killed. What are you hearing from your district about the collective trauma for young people over this last month and the body of residents? And what do you want to see the greater Boston community do to show up in solidarity for the members of your district?
Yeah, folks, there are so many layers of trauma here. We have really been drinking from a fire hose. Black Americans, marginalized communities, just the layer of trauma of being disproportionately impacted by the pandemic, the consecutive murders of unarmed Black Americans, the tragic disruption of a young life in Terrence. It has been unrelenting. I have reached out to the White House because I want to ensure that this recovery is one that's trauma-informed. Our young people, Tiziana, were already carrying so much in their emotional backpacks, navigating community and crossing the threshold into our schools every day. And that was pre-pandemic. You know, poverty has grown, food insecurity, so many destabilizing factors, homelessness, gentrification, displacement, fear of deportation, exposure to violence in all its forms. So what I've called for is for the Biden-Harris administration to have a summit on child trauma, and to talk about community-based solutions to be responsive to that trauma. And then, of course,
how have they responded?
They've been receptive to those conversations as I've continued to push for the recovery to be one that is trauma-informed. And so for me, that includes the acknowledgement of things in an infrastructure bill of care, you know, of care for our elders, of care for our children. It means passing bills like my counseling not criminalization bill. How is it that over the last decade, two decades, we've spent $1 billion to grow our school police to 46,000 strong, while every child does not have equitable access to a school nurse, a social worker, or a guidance counselor, or access to therapy? So, you know, I'm pushing these things legislatively. I'm pushing these things on a macro level when it comes to our relief, our recovery, and our response federally with the administration. So we just have to make the necessary investments. And that does mean access to mental and behavioral health. We have seen an increase, Tiziana, in our children with attempted suicides. Mm. Sadly, some who have been successful, including in my district, two in the Cambridge School District immediately come to mind, an increase in anxiety and depression. So the first thing we need to do is name that this is real, that trauma was already pervasive, but it has only grown and been exacerbated for our children, for our young people in the midst of this pandemic and all the other layers of trauma. The best gift you can give any child is a stable adult. And entire families and whole communities have been destabilized by this ongoing trauma, both the pandemic, the economic hardship, against the backdrop of a reckoning on racial injustice.
I'd love to, in our remaining time, pick up one other thread on the relief piece that we've just been talking about. You, along with Congresswoman Ilhan Omar and a number of other colleagues, reintroduced a bill this month to cancel all rent and mortgage payments during the pandemic. This would include the establishment of a relief fund for landlords and mortgage holders to cover losses from the canceled payments. Two questions. One, do you think you can get traction this time with a Democratic-controlled House and Biden in the White House? And two, how long can that be feasibly sustained if you can get it passed without creating another layer of economic pain and withholding those payments?
Well, the things I continue to push for are $2,000 reoccurring survival checks, $15 minimum wage, student debt cancellation, paid leave, and also canceling rent and mortgages. Alongside that, eviction and foreclosure moratoriums. We do have the vaccines, but we are still in the midst of a pandemic. We still have more work to do to sort of hit the density that we need to. And we can't have people unhoused, period. I mean, housing is a human right, but certainly it is something that has to be affirmed in the midst of a public health threat. We are still in the midst of a pandemic. So I'm going to continue to fight for relief packages that are robust and comprehensive and that leave no one behind. Although there have been some communities disproportionately impacted by the pandemic, everyone has felt the hurt and the hardship of this pandemic. And so everyone must feel the relief. And that is from tenants to small landlords. So I'm going to continue to push for the canceling of all those things, including rent and mortgages and eviction and foreclosure moratoriums. But in the American Rescue Plan, in light of the fact that we did not have that, I do serve on financial services, and we did fight for massive federal investments for rental assistance, both for tenants and to support small landlords. And the bill that you just cited also holds space for both of those hurts.
How How does your experience as a landlord and what you are hearing from renters in your district informing the details of how you're creating that or proposing that bill?
Yeah, well, I mean, at the end of the day, you know, I'm just fighting for relief for the millions of people in our country, in the Massachusetts 7th, who are just facing an unprecedented financial cliff. Folks have been unemployed. Rent and mortgage payments have continued to pile up. And until recently, the federal response was not keeping pace with the scale and scope of the crisis. Housing is a critical determinant of health, period. And it's our collective responsibility to keep families safely housed. So for me, that does mean canceling rent and mortgages so tenants and mortgage holders don't have a backlog of payments after this crisis is over. It means forgiving all rental debt to ensure, and this is important to Ziana, that the credit scores of hard hit families are not forever tarnished. And that's an issue that I'm leading on in my role with the financial services, committee. So those are the things I'm going to continue to fight for.
Last question for you. You've been in conversation with us. We've been in conversation with you since the beginning of the pandemic, throughout our nation's reckoning with systemic racism in the aftermath of George Floyd's murder. Today is a day. It's a moment in that arc. Today, is there anything you're feeling hopeful about?
Well, yes, I feel hopeful because in spite of it all, again, throughout the pandemic, I've been so inspired by the collective care and mutual aid that has emerged, people looking after and caring for their neighbors. And I continue to be inspired and strengthened by the movement that made these electoral victories possible so that we could be in a position to effectuate real systemic change. And the fact that issues like student debt and racial justice and dismantling mass incarceration and climate justice, a Green New Deal, a $15 minimum wage, which we did get into the House version of the relief package, the American Rescue Plan, before we lost it in the Senate. The fact that these are now a part of our daily discourse is an indicator of the strength of the progressive movement. And that these ideas are these policy proposals can no longer be marginalized. This is the time to advance bold, progressive policies which meet the needs of the people. And I think that this administration has a decisive mandate from the people to advance those sorts of policies. So that's what I feel hopeful about in this moment.
Congresswoman Ayanna Pressley represents the Commonwealth's 7th Congressional District. Thanks for being with us today.
Thank you.